this edition of Radio Survivor, we hear some good news from Jennifer Waits about new college radio stations. Matthew Lassar listens in on the London air raids of World War II. And then Jennifer, Eric, and I get into a wide-ranging discussion on what it means to create independent media today. I'm Paul Rees-Mandel, and I am joined by my fellow co-host and producer, Eric Klein. And we're very lucky to have Jennifer Waits, our College Radio Watch correspondent, joining us for the entirety of today's show. Welcome, Jennifer.
Thanks for having me.
So we'll get to do a little bit of College Radio Watch, and you'll also join us for our other discussions here, rather than just your one segment. And I guess to start, Eric's got a question for us.
Well, so last week we covered breaking news before it broke, and that would be that WNTI, the college station at Centenary in New Jersey, in northern New Jersey, had been shut down by the administration at that college, but the reasons why it had been shut down were not officially known. It was just a rumor. And we had a College Radio Watch interview, and I encourage people to listen to that because you guys, you and Paul, especially gave a lot of advice to college radio stations who might have concerns that something similar can happen to them. I know in the past, Paul has not wanted to call it a trend in college radio, and yet here at Radio Watch, we have covered now more than twice college stations being sold out from under the people that love those stations, usually for money. So here it is happening again. And this time, though, on episode 19, when we talked about it, it was just prior to the press release coming out 3 days later after we recorded the podcast, detailing everything that I could say wasn't a huge surprise, right, to anybody who had been paying attention. But yet, then we had the details, and I was able to read that press release at the conclusion of the segment. But here we are, and we're all together again. So was there anything in that press release that that was a surprise?
Well, I think also what happened was we found out that University of Pennsylvania is the group that will be purchasing the license, and they're going to use it for their radio station, WXPN. And that was a station that was rumored. I didn't mention names of the stations that were rumored, but that was one of the stations that was rumored to be the station that could potentially be taking over the signal. So that to me wasn't a surprise. I guess maybe not much of the release was a surprise.
Yeah. So we could say that WXPN, the University of Pennsylvania station, is well, what can we say about that station now that we know that that's who is taking over the frequency?
Well, it's a music-oriented station, which was the case at WNTI. WXPN has some programming that was actually aired on WNTI also. So there's some synergy as far as content.
Right. That was a syndicated music program, right? World Cafe?
Yeah. But WNTI had a lot of local DJs doing music shows, and the big concern then and now is that if WNTI is just airing WXPN, then people in northern New Jersey aren't going to have local content anymore. And I saw some Facebook posts today from people who were tuning in because actually WXPN programming just started airing yesterday.
Right.
On WNTI.
Yesterday being, Thursday the 15th of October.
Yes. So people were saying, yeah, they were hearing local traffic reports for Philadelphia.
Aww.
Which
a classic regional problem.
Mm-hmm, which was not helpful for northern New Jersey. So just, you know, a few little anecdotes like that. That's what I'm hearing so far is that, you know, and it remains to be seen. We don't know if they're going to restructure it somehow and have customized content for northern New Jersey or if it's just going to be simply repeating the programming from WXPN.
Right. And meanwhile, the WNTI people in northern New Jersey they do in fact officially have a college radio station that is online only.
Well, that's the plan, is that, you know, the studios will remain and it will be an online station, and they're really going to do work to recruit students to it. Because it sounds like students haven't really been involved in WNTI recently. It's mostly been community DJs. So it sounds like the school would like to have a student-oriented internet station.
It was interesting to me at the bottom of the press release that WXPN at the University of Pennsylvania put out, along with the Centenary College in New Jersey, put their name on it. But it looked like it was written by the PR people at the University of Pennsylvania. They talked about the price tag. They talked about how much that station was worth on the market. And it was, that was shocking. I liked seeing such a bold use of dollars and commas. It was over $1 million.
$1.25 million.
Plus $500,000 over the next something years for underwriting.
Yeah, I guess that was a surprise to see the price, because nobody was speculating about the price, or at least I hadn't seen speculations about the price before.
See, so to me, that's a problem right there, is that if one school owns something that is that valuable, dollar wise, it just seems like the incentive to find an excuse to sell it is really high.
Well, I don't think that there is too many schools, that there are too many schools that have stations that have considered getting rid of them who don't know how much their station is worth. So while this is a number which may not have been publicly known, this is a number that is known. There's no surprise to this number within sort of the public radio industry, for instance.
Yeah. So I guess I'm digging into that idea of this number because, again, this is not the first time that it has happened since we founded our little podcast. And it's, I'll go out on a limb and say that somebody somewhere is probably thinking about selling another station without telling the people who like that station that that's a plan that's in the works. And so we can go back and recommend people listen to last week's episode, episode 19, where Jennifer and Paul give some advice over the airwaves about what you should do to protect your station from such a thing. And then we also had in last week's show notes links to articles you guys have written, because it does seem like something that people who love a college station should be aware of.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing I'll add to that is specifically people who are in large metropolitan areas. So we have to note that although Warren County is not the most urban part of New Jersey, New Jersey is a very small state. And so there's still quite a population density. And then when we look in the past to stations in places like Nashville or San Francisco,
right,
very high urban dense populations. And you therefore, that makes the stations very valuable.
You mentioned both those cities because both those cities had college stations that right. were sold out from under the communities.
Yes.
Yeah. And also I would point out in the show notes from last week, we talk about some examples of colleges that were thinking of selling their licenses, and they brought this up to the student population. And in some cases, the school university community convinced the administrators to not consider selling. So it's not all hopeless. And to me, those were great examples of what people did in order to prevent a sale when everything was kind of put out in the open.
Right, but openness is not always a part of the process.
Right, so that's
exactly
why, yeah, that's why it's important to be ahead of it and make sure you are demonstrating your station's value, regardless of whether you think it's under threat.
Yeah, and it's just good practice for any of us in whatever we do to constantly be talking about why we're providing value, to be making friends. In various places in whatever group you're in. So if you're at a school, make friends in a lot of different departments. You know, it's just good business, you know, mm-hmm. to make sure that people know why you matter.
Right. Absolutely. And we have some sort of mirror image news, some happy news here, because Jennifer, you've been sort of counting up and you've realized that there are 7 new college stations that have gone on the air recently.
Yeah. So I had kind of a mammoth edition of College Radio Watch this week because I hadn't been doing kind of the normal column the past few weeks. So I was catching up on a bunch of news. And in the course of that, I found articles about 7 different stations that are either new or transitioning to LPFM, which includes Sweetbriar College, which you might remember in March earlier this year in March, it was announced that Sweetbriar College was actually going to close. They were going to shut down, which was a huge shock.
Where is that college?
In Virginia. So when I heard that Sweetbriar College was closing, I also knew that they had a permit for a new low power FM station. So I was kind of worried about that. As it turns out, Sweetbriar College was able to not shut down. So the school still exists and the LPFM has launched. So it's kind of like it's doubly good news, I think, and particularly exciting that Sweetbriar College's LPFM is on the air.
What an interesting thing that can happen if a college, we don't think about colleges going out of business, but if a college goes out of business, what happens to their college radio station?
Well, it happened at WFMU. So WFMU used to be a college radio station and its college went out of business. And then WFMU continued for a while on a dead campus where, I mean, it sounds like this really creepy
Halloween
post-apocalyptic scene where it's just WFMU there. But they had the foresight to create their own nonprofit, and then they were able to buy the license from the school. But it sounds like it was really brutal days there as the school was, I think, going bankrupt.
Yeah, it was Uppsala College in New Jersey, which went bankrupt and closed down. It's a lot easier to transfer a full power license than it is a low power license. By design, low power licenses are pretty much meant to only go to the group to which it was awarded.
Yeah. So with all of that in mind, it's so great that the station at Sweetbriar now exists. And then we had some other LPFMs that have launched recently. In some cases, it was stations that were online already, and then they picked up an LPFM license. So, now they're both. Merrimack College in Massachusetts, they launched a new student radio station. And that one, I think, is online only. And then there's an interesting one that is kind of a different category. Texas A&M launched an HD commercial college radio station. And it's a partnership with a commercial radio group called Bryan Broadcasting. So this commercial group and a agricultural communications and journalism program in the school, in the Department of Agricultural Leadership, Education, and Communication. That's a mouthful. It's a partnership between this commercial group and this program at the school. So it's a very interesting partnership, partnering with a corporate radio broadcaster.
Interesting.
But this is going to be on an HD sub-channel, correct? This is not... So it's an HD2 channel, correct?
That's my assumption.
Yeah, I think I'm looking at the story now.
Yeah,
You really got Paul's interest there. I saw his eyebrows change shape when he was like, "What?"
So
what?
Yeah,
questions. Yeah, questions.
Yeah. So being on an HD2 is means. Unfortunately, I'm very sour on HD subchannels. That because it doesn't really expose you to too many more listeners.
Right. It's like having an internet stream.
It's like having an internet stream that you don't tell anybody about that you can't find using Google.
But I like this because it sounds like, I mean, we're going to just wildly speculate, which is sloppy, but it sounds like they're going to have talk programming about their very niche agricultural subjects, like an academic talk shows, but maybe I'm just grasping for radio that I want to exist.
I don't know. We'll have to tune in on our HD radios if we're in Texas.
The reason why many commercial groups use HD2 stations, so it's digital subcarrier, so it's only available on an HD radio, is because that will allow them to rebroadcast it on a translator, a repeater. So you can put that onto an analog repeater if you, and it's permissible by the FCC. So they would be able to get a low powered translator station somewhere else. And you can only have a translator in the commercial band if you already have a terrestrial broadcast, but the digital only HD2 signal counts.
So who knows what they have planned.
So that could be something that would be an option open to Texas A&M, which would be kind of sort of a comparatively inexpensive way to get onto the radio dial. So as an analog signal.
It could just be commercial radio. Like, it might not be that fancy nerd talk stuff that I was
hoping. We don't know about that.
Yeah. I want to add that there have been instances where college radio stations have been sold, and then as kind of a carrot, they've been given or offered a chance to broadcast on an HD channel. So we've seen this before where it's kind of like their parting gift.
but consolation prize.
Yeah, but this is different in that it's all planned and it's not a consolation prize.
No, I would say it's a big win for the commercial station because, I mean, if they have an HD transmitter, they might as well be transmitting additional HD2 or HD3 programming. And to be able to get good programming from a college and also sort of get the goodwill. You know, I think it's pretty good PR. I think it's a fine win. And you know, while I'm critical of it in one way, it certainly is better than not having the HD2 signal.
And I think they're talking about how this is a really great opportunity for the students to have commercial radio experience. So this will be a very, very hands-on, pragmatic, great way for them to be working with a commercial radio group. So it makes sense for what they want to do.
Right. Are there any other stations that stood out to you? I guess they're mostly low power FM, except for one internet station that you are.
Well, there's also an internet station launching at University of British Columbia called Heatwave Radio. So that's internet only. And they hope to have a terrestrial station at some point, which, of course, is a different process in Canada. But I always like to try to keep track of what's going on with Canadian college radio when I can. So that was cool to hear. And then there's some more LPFMs at San Joaquin Delta College in Stockton, California. And then University of Oklahoma, their online station is moving to LPFM. And then Concord University, which is in Athens, West Virginia, also has a new LPFM. So lots of, it's kind of like, I keep saying October is sort of like college radio month in a way, you know, now that school is back in session and kind of the introductory part of the year is underway. We're starting to hear more about plans for radio stations and, you know, these profiles of stations that are up and running, which is pretty exciting.
It's great. I mean, and radio just keeps growing. There are more stations this quarter than the previous quarter. We know that for a fact, thanks to the FCC's quarterly report.
I love those.
and low power FM is a big component of it. And it's great to see that colleges are taking advantage of both low power FM internet radio and the opportunity to be on HD2. That's all very good news for
it
us.
Is good news. Yes.
For us radio lovers.
So there is good news about college radio, Eric.
I'm happy to hear it.
Eric, I think, worries a bit.
And then as a few weeks back, you mentioned that there's a contest being run by College Broadcasters, Inc. And Next Radio, which is the app that lets you use the FM tuner built into your Android smartphone. Allows you to use that very easily, and that they were having college students make commercials for it. And I guess they've announced their winners.
Yeah, they just announced the winners. Part of what the winners are winning is trips to CBI's conference, which is coming up. So they just announce who these folks are who are getting trips to the conference. And the first place winner is Thomas Baker III from Lincoln College in Lincoln, Illinois. And he did a spot called Data Pigs, and it's already being featured in Next Radio's national campaign. So you might hear this spot over commercial radio stations.
We can listen to it here.
We can.
Welcome to the Data Farm. These are the Data Pigs, Spotify and Pandora. They eat a lot of your data, and you have to pay more for it. But now there's a new alternative. The Next Radio app. The Next Radio app actually consumes 10 times less data than the Data Pigs. Next Radio saves your data and battery by streaming from the tiny FM chip in your smartphone. With the Next Radio app, you can listen to your favorite FM stations for free without taking up all your data.
And then the second place winner, Taylor Shainland, is from Central Washington University in Ellensburg, Washington. And the third place winner, Ryan Flannery, is from Seton Hall University in South Orange, New Jersey. And you can hear all the winning spots on Next Radio's website as well.
And we'll, of course, put links to that in the show notes, along with many other things we discuss, which you can find at radiosurvivor.com/podcast.
And I guess we should just in case people don't listen to every single episode of this podcast, they might not know entirely what we're talking about when you're talking about this chip inside the phone. Because we have talked about
it. I thought
I
described it pretty clearly.
Did you? Have I been taking naps again? It's available for Androids. It's not available for iPhones.
Right.
There's a bit of a policy fight about why they won't turn it on. Let alone a consumer rights, I guess, fight about why we can't have all our phones just be radios too. And, you know, it may be there's a data plan conspiracy somewhere lurking there, but not necessarily. I guess that's just the stuff I wanted to include.
Well, and the spots are interesting because they definitely help to explain what it is. And one of them talks about how it turns your phone into a transistor radio, basically. So that's the way I like to think about it, is you can just listen to the radio on your phone and you're not using up data. You're actually listening to FM through the airwaves.
Right. And Next Radio is cool because it knows about the stations near you. So it knows about the stations and knows the programming. So it's a little more sophisticated than just simply being a radio app.
Neat.
Oh, that's cool.
Well, now I think it's time we hear from Matthew. Here is Lasar's radio letter.
This is Trafalgar Square. The noise that you hear at the moment is the sound of the air raid sirens. I'm standing here just on the steps of St. Martin's in the Fields.
That was Edward R. Murrow reporting for CBS in 1940 during the Nazi air blitz on London. He was talking to people around the world via shortwave AM. This is Matthew Lasar with Lasar's Letter on Radio. Lots of people have written about Murrow's broadcasts, the significance of them, the politics of them, the impact of them. What very few observers have noticed is how Murrow took the time to just let his listeners, well, listen.
A searchlight just burst into action off in the distance. One single beam sweeping the sky above me now. People are walking along quite quietly. We're just at the entrance of an air raid shelter here, and I must move this cable over just a bit so people can walk in. I can see just straight away in front of me Lord Nelson on top of that big column. There's another searchlight just square behind Nelson's statue.
This was new, I think. Compare Murrow's communiques to a live media event of just a few years earlier. Journalist Herbert Morrison's coverage of the ferry crash of the Hindenburg Zeppelin in 1938.
Just enough to keep it from... It bursts into flames. Get it started. It's crashing. It's crashing terrible. Oh, my. Get out of the way, please. It's burning, bursting into flames, and it's falling on the mooring fast, and all the folks between it. This is terrible. This is one of the worst catastrophes in the world. Oh, it's...
Morrison just can't stop talking.
Oh, 400 or 500 feet into the sky, and it's a...
Edward R. Murrow, on the other hand, excelled in long pauses that allowed his listeners to hear London while following his broadcast. Murrow understood that the Battle of London was the story, not him. That, ironically, is one of the reasons why we remember him. This is Matthew Lasar for the Radio Survivor podcast, signing off.
Here comes one of those big red buses around the corner. Double-deckers they are. Just a few lights on the top deck. In this blackness, it looks very much like a ship that's passing in the night, and you just see the portholes. There goes another bus. More searchlights come into action. You see them reach straight up into the sky, and occasionally they catch a cloud and seem to splash on the bottom of it. I'll just ooze down in the darkness here along these steps and see if I can pick up the sound of people's feet as they walk along. One of the strangest sounds one can hear in London these days, or rather these dark nights, just the sound of footsteps walking along the street, like ghosts shod with steel shoes.
Thank you, Matthew. And what I find interesting about that actually is how much in sort of contemporary radio production, you know, and especially in the storytelling style now that has become so popular, as popularized sort of by This American Life, sound design, which includes music, but also includes, you know, actuality, includes
ambient
sound, is really important and is why people like a lot of things like This American Life. But you even hear it on many reported packages on All Things Considered, right, where you'll get a little bit, not quite the same kind of, it's not quite the same energy because it's all post-produced.
Sure. Well, that is where Ira Glass first shined his light on radio, was doing reporter packages on All Things Considered that got a lot of positive feedback.
Is that true?
Yeah, I think he talked about covering the Exxon Valdez. Right. I don't know if he used ambient sound for that particular story, but yeah, that's where he started.
Right. And it's very much in that kind of, you know, show, don't tell. And in radio, it's different because it's all auditory and you have to kind of fill in a lot more blanks as a listener. And the host has its choices, the host or right, the narrator makes in what they point out explicitly in words and what they allow the listener to take in.
That's funny, because I was listening to Matthew's advice about how to make good radio and to have pregnant pauses and let people listen, and then wondering, like, well, what do Radio Survivor listeners need to hear? What would we be pointing our microphones at if it wasn't our own faces?
Well, especially because it's so meta, right? Because we are talking about right, radio.
Well, we could be pointing it at the radio more often.
That's right.
We could have our radios on in the background.
Yeah. Well, you know, when you talk about college radio stations each and every time, I want to hear them. And yet that would be, I don't want to just hear them right now because maybe this minute they're not playing music I would like. So I want to spend a day with them, right? And then who has the privilege to do that sort of thing?
You want to hear the sizzle reel, right? You want to hear the best of what they have to offer.
Actually, I just want to live in that town. Right, and turn on that station when I choose to, all the time. But yeah, so that's one thing we could be pointing our microphones at, is the radios.
To back up, I just wanted to say about Matthew's piece, it's interesting, the sounds that were captured by those war reports, the air raid sirens, I mean, it just transports you to this time and place. And even though I wasn't alive during that war, it makes me think about my parents being afraid of war and people having fallout shelters. And it's incredible just hearing that small clip. It can take you to so many places, even decades after the event.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Survivor Show. We hope you're enjoying it. And if you have anything to say about any of the topics we've been discussing, or maybe there's something you think we should be covering, some person or a station or a project that you think deserves attention, please do let us know. Send us an email to podcast@radiosurvivor.com, or you can tweet us @RadioSurvivor, and it's all one word, @RadioSurvivor. Also, if you wouldn't mind giving us a review on iTunes, we certainly would appreciate it. Click some stars or leave an actual review. You could be critical. We'd love to get feedback. But when you leave a review or you click stars, it makes it easier for other people to find us in iTunes, which is still the number one way that people find new podcasts. We hope you'll help spread the word about Radio Survivor and about great radio. and we could use your financial support. Each of us dedicates hours and hours of our time every week to bring you the Radio Survivor podcast and to bring you RadioSurvivor.com. And we're doing it non-commercially. And we're able to do that now because of listeners and readers just like you who support us financially. Go to RadioSurvivor.com/support to see the ways in which you can also help us out with a small contribution. Thanks. Eric and I had a great opportunity to attend an event sponsored by the University of Oregon School of Journalism and Communication. They have a center here in Portland called the Turnbull Center, and it was called Creating and Consuming Media for a Better Future. And we got to see two panel discussions on these topics, then followed by what they call a design charrette. We broke into like these little groups to go discuss particular questions or issues that were raised or catalyzed by listening to the two panels. And they were good panels, I thought.
Well, they were linked to the Nation magazine, mm-hmm. right? Because the Nation magazine was having an event later on in the evening.
Yes.
So they could mine all of that intellectual talent all day long. So, you know, we had John Nichols, we had Zoe Carpenter, and Ifan Ubel was, I don't think he's not affiliated with the Nation, but he was there as well, as was Sarah Merck. That's the first panel.
And she is from Bitch Magazine.
Yeah, Sarah Merck is I guess we'll call her a local Portland treasure. She's an editor of Bitch Magazine. She's also a podcaster with Bitch Magazine, and she writes for the Portland Mercury, and you know, her resume is probably longer than that.
Right. And so they took up questions like, what are the abiding principles of independent journalism that still resonate? What makes, and then, you know, looking at questions like what makes media independent, which is a question I think that always sort of hangs in the air with community radio and with Radio Survivor in a lot of ways, this
right.
question of independence and what makes it independent. You know, and I think you could even say a question of like, now that, you know, if we look back at the first thing we discussed today, WNTI and WXPN, is that independent media? It is owned by a university, kind of a college station, but it also is very much like a public station and has, you know, these public radio affiliations. Is that independent radio? And I don't have a good answer, but I think it does sort of raise those questions.
Right. So John Nichols of The Nation magazine, he mentioned on the panel that if you can speak truth to power and not worry about having negative consequences at your job, either financially or office politics wise, if you are allowed to speak truth to power, whatever that means, then you get to call yourself an independent journalist. I thought that was a reasonable definition. And then Dave Zirin, who is on the next panel, also now with The Nation magazine, also one of the best talk show radio guests.
Well, and with a particular focus on sports, he's probably the only progressive sports journalist.
Right. Sports out and
there.
Politics.
Yeah.
He said that that his big answer for what makes you independent is if you can be counterintuitive. So if everyone else is doing something, and that's I guess the whole body of non-independent media. So what can you do to fill the space with your own values? That sets you apart. It was interesting. I don't know if being contrary is necessary to be indie, but they seem to go together.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think, you know, part of that is what I took from it at the very least, right, is that there tends to be these narratives that become fixed in place, you know, and we would say roughly in the mainstream media, maybe, you know, which we would include both sort of corporate news, because we're talking about journalism, I think specifically, we'd talk about corporate news, whether it's, you know, your NBC Nightly News or the New York Times, as well as, you know, something like NPR. These frames and these perspectives that become fixed. And I think by being sort of contrary means, well, how do we reframe? How do we step out of that frame and approach a story from a different way, rather than everyone chasing the same interview or chasing the same story? Is there another way to look at it? I think is really part of what he was saying.
Right, and definitely Sarah Merck and then Zoe Carpenter, they had a lot to say that was really interesting about objectivity and how I wrote down, I don't think this is what Zoe Carpenter said, but my notes about her entire answer to what, how would you define indie media was objectivity is objective. And that I think that indie media at this moment in time is a lot less obsessed with what some people call the myth of objectivity, what, you know, what was once labeled the view from nowhere, that an indie journalist is allowed to have an opinion and state it. Sarah Merck said that the most successful stories that are online or in the magazine Bitch Magazine are strong opinions stated boldly, and that those stories are the ones that do the best. Mm-hmm. And so having a point of view and sticking with it, I think is a strength of the independent media personality.
I think that's refreshing. You know, because obviously every publication and every writer has an opinion. So this myth that we're supposed to be completely divorced from that just always rubs me the wrong way. There have been times when I feel like I wasn't given an opportunity to write for a certain publication because of my opinions. But I think maybe the other publication, it expresses its opinions through headlines, through the stories it chooses to write. So it's been frustrating to me as a writer to feel like there are people who don't appreciate my opinion, but yet they're expressing their opinion. They're not showing objectivity either.
Right. I mean, objectivity is a social practice, right? It's socially constructed. We have a definition for what it is, so that you can easily identify it and execute according to the code. But by its very nature, because it's socially constructed, I'd argue that means that it privileges one thing over another, right? And so one common practice in journalism around objectivity, right, is two sides to every story, right? To the extent to which it can become sort of, it's almost like a disease where two sides to every story. So it can be the person who defends slavery, right? Because we have somebody who's speaking against slavery. We must get that other side, right? Where there must always be a counterpoint. And that's in and of itself, you say, well, that's just two sides to every story. Well, but there are sometimes six or seven. How do we split the sides? You know, is it objective to get a Democrat and a Republican both speaking on an issue when we're not hearing from someone from the Libertarian Party or the Socialist Party or the Communist Party or, you know, or 19 other parties that don't make it onto the ballot as easily? You know, to say that it's objective to only get the two sides is to say, well, it adheres to a particular definition that serves particular purposes that is promulgated by people with particular interests and particular power, right? And you know, I think much of the discussion that came out there, and certainly I agree with, is more about acknowledging bias, acknowledging one's place, acknowledging one's own subjectivity, you know, what you think and what you feel and why when reporting, because that gives a reader or a listener that perspective to understand what it is. And it doesn't mean you don't pursue facts to the best of your ability and present them to the best of your ability, you know, which of course makes it difficult to say, we know, you know, something at times it's difficult to, we know 100% anything, but you can say to the best of our ability and here's why and how we know it.
Right. John Nichols also had mentioned, I think I'm paraphrasing him again, cause we didn't record the panel, but I took notes that, first, you know, it's normal in an article to state a problem, but it's abnormal in the culture now to then like conclude with your proposed solution. But he was suggesting that that's a preferred way to write about what's going on in the world today, is that not just to cover the problems, but really try to advocate for solutions, which is not usually a media maker's assigned cultural role.
Not as a journalist, but, you know, when we draw that line often, if you're on the op-ed page, or you're a columnist. And I think that those lines are a little more blurred online because we don't have a page, so to speak, often. Mm-hmm. So if you're Maureen Dowd, for instance, certainly you can write about what the solutions you think should happen. But we also presume, rightly or wrongly, that she is also a journalist of sorts and so is coming at it from a position of knowledge and a position of having done some reporting or research. And I say we presume because I'm not necessarily saying that I know that. But we did that. I mean, we crossed that line ourselves on the last episode, right, when Jennifer and I were talking about WNTI at Centenary College. And we then crossed over and began to give advice to the volunteers of a station like Centenary's WNTI, saying, here's what we think you might consider doing in ways of saving that station or girding your station.
Because you're not being objective and saying this is a story. This is like something that's happening out in space. Mm-hmm. We are saying that here's a radio station where something bad happened. We're being subjective. And because we think it's bad that this station is being shut down, here are some solutions or advice. I mean, if you don't have values, which is, I like that part, I can point my finger at you and Jennifer and say that you have values that you're willing to state publicly about what you care about, and that's why you write what you write.
And then especially, and I think with the podcast, it gives us even more freedom to do that. Because I'll write stories that are more objective, in quotes, looking just about kind of the facts of what happened. But I might write another piece about advice. But on the podcast, I think it's a chance for us to talk about the stories and then speculate, offer opinions, which is another reason why I like doing the podcast. I think it gives us just another outlet to talk about things in a different way.
And there was something else that John Nichols said, not to make this the all John Nichols show, but he mentioned he thought
he was like the elder statesman.
He was
the
elder
panel,
statesman so on the panel. Okay. Yes. There was in some discussion about the independents to say that to not be a slave to the clicks, not be a slave to the page views, which is certainly something that we've talked about a few times now on the podcast, usually very specifically regarding listeners and podcasts, but nevertheless, and he's speaking about the web realm, but really talking about to be independent is to some extent not chasing the page views.
Right. But then Dave Zirin, who was on the next panel, gave John Nichols, his partner there at the Nation magazine, a little poke, pointing out that one of his stories that he's been chasing doggedly is very popular click wise.
Yeah.
And it happens to be a story where it was a NBA player who had his leg broken by the NYPD. And it's for many fascinating reasons that we won't get into. It's not being covered in the media very much at all. It's almost a non-story. So the fact that Dave Zirin sees this event, knows that it's a story that needs to be reported, and for reasons that are really fascinating, is the only national journalist reporting that story. There he's done something as an independent journalist that gets a huge amount of clicks for The Nation magazine because he knows that it's important when the rest of the media landscape, the rest of the reporters who are covering sports are unable or unwilling to tackle that story. That was a very interesting example.
But I take it as a different reading, right? Because on the one hand, it's valuing the clicks versus valuing getting a story out, right? And so let's say, for example, Dave Zirin's piece catches fire.
Yeah.
Okay, so then Sports Illustrated and ESPN and sports writers at the New York Times start to cover the pace to the extent to which maybe now they're getting more clicks than Dave Zirin is at The Nation. What was more important, the clicks on the piece in The Nation or the fact that the story finally was promulgated?
Right. Well, but that's strangely not happening. There's been plenty of time.
Sure.
For but that I'm particular
just,
leg
yeah,
break.
Yeah, and I'm just sort of
I wonder
drawing it
if
out,
if you
though.
Can talk about it in terms of Radio Survivor, since you guys know what kind of stories you write get the most clicks. Has there ever been a nice example of of a popular story being something you were extremely proud of, and vice versa? Has there ever been an example of like, well, we did it. We did this story, and it certainly did get a lot of clicks. And
well, I mean, for me, I wasn't necessarily expecting it, but I was intrigued by the whole Harold Camping, Family Radio, end of the world situation. And I happened to schedule a tour and visit right during the whole media. Just
yeah, can you lay blitz. That out in case people don't know those terms?
Yeah, so Family Radio is a longtime Christian radio network all over the world, and I just happened to catch one of their radio shows and heard this guy, Harold Camping, who was the CEO, or, well, he was the head of it, but he said, I think God was the CEO. I forget exactly. God was really the boss. But he had a call-in Christian talk show for 50 years, and I happened to catch it one day where he was talking about the end of the world, and it was riveting. And the callers were trying to attack what he was saying, but he was just kind of unswerving. And so I became fascinated and realized that he was based in Oakland, right near where I live. So I scheduled a tour, not quite realizing all of this big media blitz, because he was placing billboards all over the world about the end of the world coming.
I saw one of those billboards in Oakland.
I'm sure you did. They were on BART. They were in New Zealand. A ton of money was spent on marketing. And the day I visited, I got to interview him briefly. There were other media outlets at Family Radio headquarters. So I wrote about that visit. And then I subsequently kept sort of following what was going on as it became clear that the world did not end. And there was a press release that I wrote about. So I wrote about every twist and turn of it, but we had never seen that kind of traffic on Radio Survivor. I was sort of unprepared for that. So every time we posted an article, all of a sudden I'd start getting notifications for comments because people were commenting. And it was crazy. And then you get sort of addicted to that. And so you feel like, I want to write more because, you know, this is getting us a lot of attention. But at the same time, I was also very proud because my first story was more about what Family Radio was like as a radio station. And I wrote very respectfully about that aspect of it. And most of the other articles that people were writing were kind of making fun of it, like it was a big joke. And so I think I did actually maintain more objectivity. Because I was not a follower of their practices at all. In fact, I was kind of scared even visiting Family Radio because I thought people would, I don't know, attack me because I wasn't a believer. And so it was kind of a big deal for me to go there knowing that my beliefs were so different from everybody there. And then to write about it more as a radio story.
Mm-hmm.
I felt really proud of that. And there are people who commented on that, you know, we appreciate that you covered this in a different way. You know, I actually toured the whole operation. So I got to see the studios and the record library while everybody else was, you know, just focused on trying to talk to Harold Camping and videotaping his final Bible study, et cetera.
For the world that did not end.
For the world that did not end, yes.
But I think
it was a spiritual end of the world, apparently.
Right. I think you uncovered a dark side of objectivity, right? Right. The fact that the main story was that he's a kook says that, okay, we all agree he's a kook. That's an objective fact, right?
Mm-hmm.
I might look at Howard Camping myself, Harold Camping myself, and say, yeah, it's pretty kooky. I kind of agree with that. But they could also be looking at somebody who is advocating for immigrant rights in a particular way, right? Or who's advocating for, you know, someone who might have been advocating for marijuana legalization, a member of Normal 25 years ago might have been considered a kook, or somebody who was advocating for same-sex marriage 25 years ago may have been regarded as a kook.
Or Bernie Sanders 2 months ago.
Or Bernie Sanders months ago regarded as a kook. And because we can all take that fact for granted, now we don't have to treat the subject with respect, nor do we have to do diligent reporting or consider
exactly
what might be their arguments. We can dismiss their arguments,
it's true, and that really bothered me. But you know, I would also say I do think he was a kook, and he also espoused some beliefs that are really horrific. So I'm not trying to defend Harold Camping in any way, but I think it was still worth writing about it as a radio story, as opposed to just writing about it like, this is a kook, this is crazy. Because sure. Yeah, then you're not digging into it at all.
Well, that's a dark side of radio though too, is that not every idea should be spread.
Well, and it was a very popular station, right? With great reach, with many affiliates, including
very valuable, you know, they had stations in New York City and, you know, and that's how they funded a lot of this marketing that they did, was through selling some of these high profile stations that they owned.
And they had a shortwave station too, correct?
Yeah.
So there was a global presence.
Yeah. Which actually people were really upset when they shut that down. Because I think not only was it sending out family radio content, but I think they were helping to send out other content. But yeah, when I visited, you know, they had maps showing where they reached, and they had publications being printed in every language imaginable. And I was shocked that I'd never heard family radio before. Right. It'd been around forever, and I'd never run across it until right before the apocalypse.
Right. I mean, and to understand it, you first have to sort of take it seriously. And taking it seriously doesn't mean you have to believe it or believe their beliefs or to, you know, but you first have to sort of keep it in your mind, right? And to think about it and to consider it and right. And to look at it, you could say, okay, well, he's a kook, but you know, does that mean there are therefore millions and millions upon other kooks out there listening to him? Are that, you know, I mean, you know, and to really consider how one might take these messages seriously or also maybe assume that they are rational thinking individuals who may not necessarily take his messages seriously or believe them outright, but because his Christian beliefs also match up with many of their beliefs that he'd give them some consideration. I mean, right. And I think you did a great fairness to that story. And I think because you did it the right way, the fact that it brought in traffic, you know, doesn't make me feel as though you sold your soul or we sold our soul for that traffic.
And it wasn't my goal wasn't, this is a hot story. So
it was true curiosity, right?
Yeah, it was true. You know, it was like the one instance where a radio story was a huge mainstream story. And so we benefited from that as far as traffic. I think, you know, I know other people that have to write basically following the trends. And so they're probably thinking every day, okay, what can I write about on our site that's going to take advantage of what people are searching for? You know, so you end up writing about celebrities or, you know, things that are hot topics in the news. And that's a dangerous, kind of sad part of what's happening with online writing right now, I think, is that you're chasing those clicks.
I wanted to ask Paul what's the most clicked story he's written in recent memory.
I don't know, to tell you the truth.
Well, some of your stories about my such and such as an internet radio, haven't those been really popular?
Those are pretty popular, yeah. So I'll write, my iPad is an internet radio, my Chromecast is an internet radio, and they are popular. And I
Gizmo reviews.
Yeah. And that is at least one reason I'll admit that I write them. I write them also because I am honestly curious.
Yeah. In another life, you could be working for Gizmodo.
Or something like that, yes, and be writing 60 posts a day based upon press releases. And then the occasional post where I'm actually engaging the front part of my brain.
Paul, yeah, Paul just had an opinion there.
But
oh my God,
rewriting press releases is so much fun as a journalist. But I write those out of curiosity, and I write them because I think actually I'm taking a slant that is not being taken by even the tech writers who I believe are who I like and respect and believe do good writing and good journalism, because I'm taking it from the angle of, well, how do I get radio wherever I am? How do I get radio on this device? And I know that people are getting these devices and buying these devices, and they are looking, how do I listen to the radio on my iPad or my Chromecast? And so we might as well fulfill that question, you know, and answer it. And I don't really have a problem doing it, because it's a question I answer for myself. I don't get sent an iPad from Apple to review it, and I haven't been sent a Chromecast by Google. I bought these things or was gifted them, you know, for like a birthday, and said, well, how the heck am I going to listen to radio on it? And so, yeah, those tend to be fairly popular. And then I also have stations that I get curious about. And there's a station called MeTV Radio in Chicago, which is on Channel 6. It's the analog Channel 6 television. So it's a low power television station. Those are the only television stations still allowed to broadcast in analog. And it bumps up against the low end of the FM dial. So you hear it on basically about 87.7 FM, which is otherwise not a real FM station, but most radios receive it. So it broadcasts as if it were an FM radio station. And if you see it on television, one of the like six people who still watches analog television in the Chicago area, you just see a billboard basically on the screen and you hear the radio.
Huh.
And I've been following, and this station has changed hands multiple times now just in the last 7 years. And it's fascinating to me, these what I call backdoor FM stations. And most recently, it was taken over by the people who do MeTV, which is a nationwide network, and basically they do reruns. It's kind of like TV Land used to be. It's reruns and classic television on the like HD2 or HD3 channels.
Right. I just learned about this because I
– on digital television.
After many, many years without television in my life, I actually bought an antenna mm-hmm. for digital television and discovered that there's a lot of that.
So you'll find that. Yeah. So Weigel Communications out of Chicago, they were way ahead of the curve on this, and they set up, you know, basically rerun television that then gets distributed on these extra sub channels that every digital television broadcaster has. And most of them don't have anything, have a lot of programming to go on to it. And it's nostalgia based. It's pretty well put together. So if you want to watch, you know, reruns of Hogan's Heroes or reruns of Columbo, and I want to watch both of those, so I tend to watch MeTV. And then they took over this radio station in Chicago that had been bounced around from owner to owner. Low power television station that's on the radio. And they started programming it with MeTV Radio, which is a nostalgia format.
Ooh, okay.
And so they're playing like moldy oldie and one hit wonders. So like basically all these kind of like old hit songs that aren't part of the typical classic rock or oldies rotation, because they aren't like established audiences or aren't the songs that were popular for more than maybe a month or two. And you can't listen to it online. They don't even have a web stream. And the interesting thing, though, is because we've written about it a few times, we have pages of comments, but these are all people writing to us as if we were the broadcaster.
Oh, because they don't even have an online presence.
No, it has a website, but that's it. There's no message board or anything. And so people leave these messages like, love what you're doing. I wish you had an online stream so I could listen in my office.
Wow. Comment to us on a radio station.
That's another
Dave Zirin-ish. And those posts every week.
That's fascinating.
Get another, tons of hits.
That's another one that reminds me of what Zirin said on the panel, is that like if you just do what you look at what everyone else is doing, and then you do the thing that they're not doing that you're very interested in.
And that's it.
And so you all of a sudden filled a void that there's other people in the world that care.
I got a press release from the MeTV people earlier this week because they hired a new program director. And to me, that's not terrifically interesting news. I didn't really write about it because I'm not just going to be only that beat. but if, you know, if that program director meant they were changing their programming or something like that, I'd write about it. But they sent me a very personal email that said, hey, we've seen you written quite a bit about MeTV Radio. We just hired Rick O'Dell, who is bounced around Chicago radio for quite some time. And, you know, as our new program director, maybe you'd want to write about it.
Maybe we should have Rick O'Dell on the podcast. The next time we don't know who to talk
he
to.
He was the smooth jazz king of Chicago.
I bet you so, he has an institutional memory that if he's willing, he's willing to blab.
He might be. He's an interesting dude. And that station, 87.7 FM, I don't know, even know what the call letters are now, but the Channel 6, he ran it for a little while as a smooth jazz station. And then they sold it to Tribune Broadcasting, who ran it as a sports talk station, who then sold it to Weigel Broadcasting, who now run it as MeTV Radio. And just a side note, I should put this in the show notes. The sports talk that was run by Tribune Broadcasting on there. The guys who were doing like the midday talk program found out that the station was getting shut down while they were on the air because someone tweeted it to them because management had told them. It got captured. So I wrote about this because it's an interesting story because they also had a YouTube stream going on at the same time. Wow. And so it's out there. You watch them going, oh, well, this just in. They're shutting down our station.
Only on radio does it happen that way. I mean, there's something so unique about having your radio station shut down.
Well, and right.
Because and you're talking. You're in mid-sentence.
And there's no – and unlike television, okay, you don't have a director, right? You don't have a floor manager. You don't have a line producer. So there's nobody – there's almost nobody there. You know, you're generally operating the controls yourself. Yeah. So there's nobody there to cut the wires, basically, to cut the feed, and there's nothing to go to, right? Which is kind of why I love radio, why live radio is still really cool. Some of my favorite moments listening sometimes to like commercial AM radio sometimes is the moments when they screw up, when they put up the wrong feed, or you know, there's somebody caught flat-footed and they can't get the thing, and they go, oh, hi, we'll get back to Rush Limbaugh in a moment. And they don't know what to do because they don't even have CDs or records, right, to play to fill in the gap. So, yes, that's a great part of radio. But anyway, we've gone off on a major digression there.
I think this is the episode of digression.
That's fine. It's a wonderful – I'm enjoying it. And but I think it's our way of saying, you know, how we're sort of revealing a little bit how we balance the needing – well, we used to need clicks more back when we had web ads because you got paid per click. But balancing that sometimes human need to want to be popular or to write things that become popular and to get that kind of feedback, which is always very nice, versus – staying true, at the very least, to ourselves and our own sense of integrity and our own sense of purpose and what we think is right, as well as, I think, staying true to our readers and listeners and making sure that we are those who come to us for the same values, more or less, that we embrace and that we purport, that we're not we're not alienating them by taking, you know, sharp right turns to cover something simply because it's popular and getting covered everywhere else.
It reminds me of Facebook and how you can have thousands and thousands of likes. Your media organization, for instance, can have tens of thousands of likes, and that undervalues your website. Because none of those such a weird minority of those likes are real humans, and then even less of those people genuinely care. They're just internet butterflies.
Or moreover, very few of them actually click through and read anything.
Yeah, and or you can have hundreds of readers, and one might make you slightly more money with the way advertising is currently working on the internet, but that model is also in serious
under siege.
Decline. Yeah.
Under
so,
siege.
So you'd rather have 100 real readers than tens of thousands of clicks.
That I think that's the position I've been sort of advocating, or 100 real listeners. And I think that's what we're trying to do. And we're just trying to figure out how to make it work.
Yeah. Well, did you want to talk about, so Barrett Anderson, who also has this new, she was also a panelist at this media conference that Paul and I were so privileged to get to attend. But she, from the back of the room at the end of the conference, wanted to talk about owning your own platform as opposed to going onto the current corporate popular platforms that are so vital to any media organization on the planet now.
Yeah, Facebook and Twitter and
Pinterest.
You need
a Facebook.
Yeah. I mean, that is always a big question. I mean, we use Facebook. We have a Facebook page. And we don't channel much energy towards it. I don't think we mostly just make sure that our Facebook people who like us on Facebook see our newest stories. We don't have a lot of conversation going on Facebook, which some people would say is a problem because you're not having engagement. I'm using air quotes.
Yeah.
But if we did have engagement there, we're mostly privileging Facebook. We are, you know, we are giving Facebook all of that traffic, and we're not able to. And so it's Facebook owns it for all intents and purposes, opposed to Radio Survivor owning it. And I hope that when Radio Survivor owns it, it's more of a community thing, that we share that ownership rather than it being something which we are monetizing, also in air quotes, understanding that people need to make money, but that we're not, you coming to our site and clicking on it doesn't therefore make 1/100th of a penny go into a bank account somewhere.
Yeah. So when Barrett Anderson of Scout brought that up at the conference, that's when I spoke up and started telling people all about Ken Friedman's Audience Engine, which I thought was extremely relevant, since that was the goal of Ken Friedman's project with Audience Engine, is to pull fans of stations specifically, but media organizations or other organizations more broadly, to pull those people back, to pull them away from Facebook and get them active in places where they're not going to be monetized by this other for-profit corporation.
Well, right, to bring them back to their own websites. Yeah. I think very simply. And for that conversation, which is what we hope happens in social media, to be part of a station's own website. And we're talking about non-commercial stations or sort of non-commercial like enterprises.
Like Radio Survivor.
Like Radio Survivor. Because also, what Facebook gives, Facebook taketh away. Right. You know, in the way that not everyone you follow, do you see all their posts? And there's, you know, when that first happened, there was a lot of discussion and hubbub about that.
Yeah. They've taken away the real time stream on mobile. It's gone.
Yeah. It's pretty much gone, period. Right. And there may be good reasons for it. I'm not necessarily criticizing Facebook one way or the other, but I'm just simply pointing out it's a change over which nobody got a vote. We hope that a station can host conversations and host, you know, about music, about what's on the air, can host a chat, can host all sorts of interesting engagement, so to speak, with listeners, with supporters, with readers, without giving it away and giving it away to Facebook, which is selling ads against it, essentially, and making money off of it, because that's like this little siphon, I think, that goes away.
So that's something that we're about to see, right, in the real world, where Ken Friedman's Audience Engine is partnering up with KEXP in Seattle.
Yeah, we won't see that engagement part for a while. That's not being released right away. So in November, it's the monetization side of it, the fundraising side of it is being released.
So it's hard to say when we will see it. But I closed my eyes yesterday and dreamed about it, where that Beastie Boys broadcast, for instance, that I'm so fond of referencing, where they did a 12-hour Beastie Boys special broadcast that was wildly popular on the internet, was all over Twitter. Wouldn't that have been interesting for that to have been in that Audience Engine realm, where all of the KEXP fans and listeners could go onto KEXP's website to talk about that Paul's Boutique broadcast in very specifics, to put links to,
yeah, like a Reddit almost.
Right. Yeah. But
like Reddit, which is a sort of wide ranging sort of conversation.
And then the big advantage over what Facebook is doing is that you know where to go find it later. That Facebook tends to sort of weirdly obscure the past in ways that are getting more and more difficult to untangle. Yeah. I can't go back to last year. There is no permalink the way there would be on a Radio Survivor blog post.
Right.
And that's no fun.
Right. Well, I mean, and that's why, again, I think we move towards this, you know, it's important to own what you do. If your podcast, your blog, you know, the best of your ability to host it and to work with other people who respect that. It doesn't mean don't ever write for somebody else or don't ever produce for somebody else, but to, I think, understand what the terms are. And perhaps if something is near and dear to you, to make sure that you continue to have that autonomy with it.
The way we use Facebook on Radio Survivor generally is we're trying to point people back to our articles. So I think of it as lots of people are on Facebook, spending all day there. And so we're just trying to get like brief little messages out to them to direct them back to our website. Because we haven't really seen much of our discussion happening there. It's more just, hey, we just wrote this article. Come back to Radio Survivor to take a look.
Yeah, and we have seen, we do see discussion at Radio Survivor. And we're getting ready to implement some new forums. So that's coming soon. It may even be in action by the time this podcast is released. And it's our way of hoping to support community amongst people who love radio, who love LPFM, who love college radio, in a place where every time they click, it's not about a hundredth of a cent going into a bank account, but really about trying to provide this forum in a place where this discussion can happen, where they can return to it, where there can be some freedom, and also, very importantly, some consistency and some reliability, that you know it's going to be there and you know why it's going to be there. So that's going to be happening soon at radiosurvivor.com. And of course, you know, that's where you need to be going, radiosurvivor.com, because beyond a podcast every day, we have stories about radio. There's college radio stories every Friday on College Radio Watch, which Jennifer brings us, low power FM stories every Thursday on LPFM Watch. But there's stuff every day about radio. Matthew's doing a lot of reporting about international community radio right now, which is a fascinating new avenue that he's decided to pursue. And of course, the podcast is at radiosurvivor.com/podcast. What do you think? Did anything we talked about today get your mind going? Did you find yourself wanting to talk at your smartphone? Send us an email at podcast@radiosurvivor.com.
What Paul means is that talk at your smartphone to record your voice telling us about what you thought about the podcast, and then email it to us so we know. And then maybe we can play it to the listeners. Jennifer, I'm so glad you could join us for our discussion today, the whole thing.
Yes, it was great to be part of this wide-ranging discussion.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Paul.